This is the 21st Show back live. I'm Brian Mackey, and we're going to spend the rest of the program today talking about a new study out of Northwestern University on the subject of online outrage. But I want to begin with something much older, a clip from the movie Network, which came out in 1976. This is arguably the most famous scene from the film. It's a television anchor cracking up live on air and trying to shake up his viewers. Oh, and a content warning. The language in this clip does violate the Third Commandment.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street, and there's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore!
I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore!
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore!
I'm not going to take it anymore!
The more things change, right? From the movie Network in 1976 to the social networks in 2023, people are mad as heck, they're outraged, really, and they are not going to take it anymore. But are they, really? A new study published in the journal Nature Human Behavior suggests maybe not. Joining us now to talk more about this is William Brady, Assistant Professor of Management and Organizations at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. He's lead author of the study. William, welcome to the 21st Show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
And listeners, we want to invite you to join our conversation today as well by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Have you been mad as heck on social media? Or maybe you've seen people outraged on social media? How does that make you feel? What do you think about that? How do you respond to it? Let us know at 800-222-9455. So William, just tell us a little bit more about the study. What inspired it? How was it conducted?
Yeah, so we wanted to investigate how outraged people are on social media. One of the interesting things about social media and other computer contexts is that you actually don't usually have privileged access into how people are actually feeling when they're communicating. So for example, someone might post a really angry message on Twitter or Facebook, but all you really have to go on to judge that person's emotions is what they're saying. But of course, there are these situations in which someone could just be like eating chips on the couch and really not feeling anything, but they're expressing themselves very angrily. And that's something that we actually don't know if that's going on as a consumer of those messages. So we wanted to do a study that looked to see whether, on average, people are able to accurately perceive the emotions of the people who are posting outrage messages in the context of political conversations. So the way that we did that is by doing a study on social media. So we actually did this on Twitter. And we invited people to participate in a study where we tracked their messages when contentious political events in U.S. politics occurred. So for example, one of the situations we looked at was the Supreme Court confirmation hearings of Amy Coney Barrett If you recall, that was a really contentious time across the political left and right. And so we identified users who expressed outrage, and then we actually sent them a direct message that asked them to report on their emotions. So specifically, we asked them, how outraged are you, using a scale response? And then we also asked them about their happiness, just to have more positive emotion as an anchor. And then we recruited another group of participants who consented to participate in the study, and we asked them to make the judgments. And so for the first time, we were actually able to compare what people said they were actually feeling at the time of posting their message with what people thought. And at least in the context of politics, what we were finding is that on average, people were overestimating the intensity of outrage that people were feeling. And we can get into why exactly that happens, but just to preview, I think a lot of what goes on is people are so used to the way that political conversations go and how people express themselves in certain social media platforms that they have an assumption. People must be really upset, really outraged. And in fact, they're overestimating that on average, according to our data.
Well, and we know, I know anyway, I've learned over time that it's tricky to communicate only through text, right? I had a younger, actually it was a college student intern, half my age, who was telling me, you know, that sometimes when people communicate online, like through Slack or some messaging medium like that, if you're not using exclamation points, you can come across as a little psychopathic. So I've learned to appear much more enthusiastic and friendly than, you know, I might feel, because you have to make up for that deficit online, right? Are we seeing sort of an opposite version of that on social media, where it's just kind of the mode that people, you know, intersperse caps in, and it makes them seem so angry?
That's right. I think it is in part what you're describing, which is to say, more specifically, I think there are norms, or as you called it, a mode of communication in certain platforms, especially where if you're talking about a certain type of information, for example, politics, you are going to have to kind of conform to how people tend to do it. And if you don't, and this is a thing that makes social media unique compared to something like text and email, if you don't express yourself with a lot of intensity, guess what happens to your message? It actually doesn't get as much exposure. Because on social media, there's the influence of content algorithms. And these algorithms actually uprank the things that draw in our attention the most. And you might guess the things that tend to draw in our attention the most are the things that are the most inflammatory. They tend to be negative. They tend to be surprising. And we have this natural psychological attraction to this type of content. And even though we might know, oh yeah, this is just how Twitter works, this is just how Facebook works, it's really hard to ignore that type of content. But the algorithms don't really know that. They're just kind of doing what they were designed to do, which is uprank that content more. And so what ends up happening is we just get saturated with the most extreme sometimes, especially in the context of politics, and the most outraged content. That can make us judge people to be more outraged than they really are, just because we're misperceiving. And also we have this general idea that people are more outraged than they than is actually representative in our underlying social network. So in other words, we see more outrage than is actually being felt because of the role of content algorithms.
Now the study looked at Twitter. Is this true across social media platforms? Could the same thing, I mean, is as best as you understand it, is the same thing true of Facebook, Reddit, other platforms?
Yes, so this is an important question. Every platform has different algorithmic behaviors that could influence. And they also have different ways that you communicate. And there's definitely differences across each. But in general, we looked at Twitter. I have another study that is looking at Reddit. We haven't looked at Facebook. But what I would argue is any platform where content algorithms are designed in a way that incentivizes attention-seeking type of content, you're likely to get a similar effect. But I will say, in our study, we only looked at Twitter. So according to the data that I'm talking about today, I can only make a claim about Twitter.
How do we know that these companies, and are all the companies doing sort of elevating this angry content over, you know, more banal sort of, oh, that happened, sort of a statement, right? And I knew this as a Statehouse reporter, right? But it was my previous job to this show. I would just post sort of a factual sentence about something happening in state government and see it, you know, would get a few retweets, a few likes or something like that. Somebody else would post, more of a hot take, and it would sort of go viral for, such as things do when you're talking about state government, which is not terribly viral. But, I could see this in my own life. How do we understand that that's what these networks are doing? Is it just through observation? Have they talked about it?
Yeah, so I think it's an important distinction to bring up that. So distinction between do they know they're doing it versus did they intend to do it? So there's enough data now, both through my work, other scientists' work in my field, and then also even internal documents from Facebook and Twitter specifically, that have documented the fact that their algorithms are systematically upranking, or in other words, producing more or selecting more of content that tends to skew angry, sometimes tend to skew more politically extreme, at least in context of politics, for example. And I think they're aware that this is happening, and there's even, some initiatives to try to reduce that, but I don't think that they necessarily designed it to produce that, to amplify that content. I think that they designed it to amplify content that grabs our attention because their profit models tend to be very tied to advertising revenue. And it's a side effect of that broader goal they have that this content gets amplified. So I think the question is, what are they going to do about it, given that this is something that has been documented for several years now? And it's complicated for a platform because their business model is tied to this stuff that actually drives more advertising revenue. At the same time, however, a lot of users are actually turned off by this kind of content. The politically extreme content and the most outraged content is actually produced by a small minority of users, and yet it spreads throughout the platform as if it was produced by more users. So I think companies have this tension where on one hand, a lot of users are exhausted by that type of outrage and political content, but on the other, it tends to drive revenue because it still can draw a lot of likes and shares. And as you mentioned, sometimes it can go viral. And again, as you mentioned, you see this with like clickbait news and other related things.
Absolutely. All right, let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Professor William Brady from the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. He's lead author on a study that was published in the journal Nature Human Behavior. It came out earlier this month. The headline on the study is Over-perception of moral outrage in online social networks inflates beliefs about intergroup hostility. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation today. That's 800-222-9455. So what are some of the dangers to this sort of outrage becoming more normalized, or at least the perception of this kind of outrage becoming normalized?
Yeah, so one of the inspirations for the study was to try and unpack some of the processes that underlie something that we've been seeing in the American public for several years now, which is a phenomenon that has been called in the past false polarization. And the idea behind false polarization is that, look, it is true that in general, when you look across the last 20 years, the American public has become a little more polarized, especially if you define polarization as negative feelings toward the political outgroup. But it turns out when you actually ask real political partisans about their attitudes toward certain things that tend to be politicized, so things like abortion, same-sex marriage, gun control, etc., it turns out that people vastly overestimate how far apart that they are from the political outgroup's attitudes on all these issues. And so this is a real problem for democracy in American politics if we're misunderstanding how potentially far apart we are on certain things. This is not to say that real differences aren't out there, but it's just to say that we tend to overestimate and exaggerate those differences. And so our study was looking at, well, because a lot of people now have conversations about politics on social media, and also news tends to, broadcast media tends to cover what happens on social media. If people are overperceiving the outrage, then this could actually be one of the things that leads into this false polarization effect that has been documented over the last several years. And in fact, in our study, we tested this. So we did a follow-up experiment where we exposed participants to all of these messages that we demonstrated to be overperceived in terms of their outrage. And what we find is that if you're in a news feed where you see these overperceived messages, it actually makes you think that your social network is more polarized against the political outgroup than they really are. And it also makes you think that it's more normative, or in other words, it's more socially appropriate for you to express high levels of outrage. And so it's not to say that outrage is a bad thing per se, but one thing I think a lot of us can agree on is we shouldn't have a misunderstanding of how much our group wants us to express outrage, because we know that this can actually influence our behavior and lead to conformity effects.
Yeah, you're not saying there are no things worthy of outrage. It's just a question of, what should we be outraged about, right? Somebody is innocent person is killed or something like that versus, you know, the latest, I don't know. I'm not even going to venture to make an analogy here. We're going to take a break.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry. Briefly.
Oh, briefly, I was just going to say yes. The content of outrage is not really in question. It's more about, you know, if we are misunderstanding how outraged others are, that seems to be a problem. But of course, different content could inspire different outrage, and there's nothing right or wrong about that.
Right. Everybody's different. All right. We're gonna come back and talk more about this after a break. If you want to join our conversation, the number to call is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Or you can always send us an email. And the address for that is talk@21stshow.org, talk@21stshow.org. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the practical effects of this, more of the practical effects in real life, what the social media outlets maybe should be doing about it. We did hear from some of you in our texting group. Terry in Springfield, for example, says, I just deactivated my Facebook account. I have no other social media. I needed a break from the hate. I think people in general are more brazen when they are not face-to-face with someone. We'll talk more about that with William Brady, Assistant Professor of Management and Organizations at the Kellogg School of Management, Northwestern University. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about a study published this month in the journal Nature Human Behavior. The headline is Overperception of Moral Outrage in Online Social Networks Inflates Beliefs About Intergroup Hostility. Put another way, you see an outraged tweet or message on a social media platform, and people tend to overestimate how angry the person was behind that message, which leads to this cycle of, well, what the political scientists or social scientists call intergroup hostility. Basically, how much negativity, and a bad feeling about the other political party is out there in America. We're talking about this with William Brady, Assistant Professor of Management and Organizations at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. He's lead author on the study. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455 is the number to call. That's 800-222-9455. And let's go now to Catherine, calling in from Normal on line four. Catherine, thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm curious, since the reporting, of course, is after the fact, so they express their anger, you call them back and see if they were as angry as they sounded. I'm curious how you know that that's not a result of their just having expressed that, vented it, and now that's taken the edge off of the anger.
That's clear? An interesting question, Catherine. Thank you for that.
Yes, this is a great question. So in our field study, the way that we have designed our method is that we're actually able to get responses within 15 minutes of them posting their message. And actually, on average, people are responding within 2 minutes of posting that. So the first answer to your question is that because we're doing this in a very fast time frame, because we're doing it all online in the context of Twitter, it helps people, you know, be very fresh with that outrage they were expressing. But it is the case that some people could potentially vent immediately, feel better. But in general, when we look at our data, we have a very broad range of people's self-reports of outrage. So on one hand, we have some people who, you know, are reporting pretty low outrage. On the other hand, we have people who are really high. And so because we have that range, we know that at least not everyone is just, you know, feeling better after they've expressed their tweet. Especially in the context of politics, I think when people are engaging in these conversations, they tend to be actively outraged for a little bit. But again, we actually find our effect across all different levels of reported outrage. And so I think you're bringing up a really good point about the method. I think some of our data suggests that we still find our effects even for the people who really are genuinely outraged at the time of reporting.
That's interesting. So you're responding like with a bot or something like that to get them right away? Or do you have people sort of standing by to reply? Or how does that work?
Yeah, we actually do kind of a mix of automation and having people stand by. But yes, it is happening all in real time, which is a really cool part of this method that we developed.
So let's talk a little bit about social media outlets handling this kind of outrage. I mean, do you think they should be doing something about it?
Yeah, so like I said, there's this tension that companies have between content that is going to really keep us active and engaged, which sometimes can mean fighting on the platforms and increasing their advertising revenue, versus content that makes us, you know, generally feel good and have a good time on the platform. You know, the listener who texted, you know, they described deactivating their account because there was so much hate. This is actually not an uncommon phenomenon. And I think platforms do have a problem with some people leaving because of the phenomenon that we've been discussing. And this is actually not good for the phenomenon, because if there's overperception of outrage, people who are not outraged leaving the platform, actually who is left on the platform is people who are, you know, the loudest and doing the most talking in these political contexts and doing the most outrage expression. So I think, you know, it's a very real problem. It affects the user experience. So I think there is some motivation for platforms to try and curb at least some of the toxicity, you might say. But it's a really complicated situation. The answer is not that we should just delete outrage from platforms, because as we discussed, you know, outrage is an emotion that actually serves important social functions. It makes us aware of things that we should care about morally, whether or not, you know, you're on the right or the left. And it also, for example, can help lower power individuals challenge the status quo by rallying people. But when it's the case that it's overrepresented on the platforms and there's more outrage than people really are, I think that's something that companies might try to target. But it's very difficult to do. One of the things that I have proposed is that content algorithms can actually be designed slightly differently. So right now, they tend to exploit the things that we are most drawn to in terms of our attention. And that has these side effects that we've been describing, where things like outrage, things like, you know, more extreme content, we don't necessarily like it, but it still draws us our attention. Think about like when you go by a car crash, you don't necessarily want to look at that, but it's hard not to. So algorithms are right now exploiting that type of thing, but maybe they could be designed in a way where it actually increases information diversity in our environment. And so rather than exploiting the biases we have in our attention, it could actually, you know, make our environment more varied. And then generally speaking, if you look at things like problem solving, the data suggests that the more varied perspectives you have, the greater the ability to collectively problem solve is. So that's one thing that social media companies could do from their end, but it's always going to be difficult because this tension between creating profit. I think actually there are individual level things that we can all do, which is start to become more educated about how algorithms actually affect the content we see. It's easy for us to assume that everything we see in the context of social media has this social reality and that it really represents what people are really feeling, you know, on average. But we have to keep in mind that, especially when it's not our friends' content that we're seeing, a lot of this content is getting upranked because of certain properties that have nothing to do with how representative that content really is, for example, outrage. And so I think increasing our literacy about how social media platforms and their model works is difficult, but I think it can help us make decisions about how we're making social inferences on the platform.
Yeah, this goes to something I've heard people say to me is Twitter is not real life, right? Just because something is big on Twitter, people are angry about something on Twitter, you go stop 100 people on the street, you might find one who's even aware of what the heck you're talking about. This also puts me in mind when you say educate yourself on the algorithms, and I want to talk a little more about what individuals can do to help sort of ameliorate this, right? They say you can't control what other people do, you can control how you respond to what other people do. But it makes me think, like, even though I watch a Star Wars movie or something, I know it's fake, I know it's computer effects and models and everything else and makeup, but I have this willing suspension of disbelief. How do you fight that on social media, right? So now I know the algorithms are promoting it, but if I see something outrageous, it's still going to have an emotional effect on me that's difficult to help.
That's right. It is difficult. You made a really good analogy with, watching a movie. I think just starting to practice keeping in mind some of the things that we've been talking about, how algorithms work, also considering that, you know, social media is like a public environment for conversation. And so when we're talking about having political conversations, you know, if you're having a back and forth with someone about hot button issues like politics, you know, a lot of times they feel like they're on the line to defend themselves, and that can make them maybe go a little more angry, a little more defensive than normal. So it's difficult because, you know, we do, you know, it's easy to get emotional on the platforms, but I think the hope is that with some of this knowledge in mind about these biases, we maybe can understand, well, why is the other side acting like this, who I'm talking to, or maybe I choose not to share something that might not be representative of even like the political outgroup. I think that's actually one very straightforward thing that I do myself. You know, it's easy to see a very fringe view, say, about the political outgroup, and sometimes you want to share that and say, can you believe that, like, the other side is thinking this? But sometimes that is actually quite a fringe view even for the outgroup or the other side. And so maybe I just won't share that because I'm aware of this bias that is occurring, because you have to be careful. Sometimes when you share what you consider to be a fringe view, you're actually increasing the legitimacy of that view because now you're bringing it into public discourse. So that's something that I think about a lot in terms of how to implement the knowledge of these biases.
Yeah, what do you want to amplify? What do you want to be responsible for amplifying in the world? Would you bring this person maybe to dinner with your family? And, you know, somebody who's shouting, anger, would you bring them into your home? Maybe that's a way to think about this. You know, we got another text message from someone in Urbana who said, I try to read anything on social media or email with a nice voice. I try to assume best intentions. It gets difficult when you know the intent of the communicator isn't positive. I think that kind of gets at what you were saying there, right? Thinking about, it's the way we sort of frame in our own minds what we're reading.
That's right. I think this is a great, again, thanks for the text. I think this is an important point. You know, it reminds me of something in social psychology that we call the fundamental attribution error. So we have a tendency for when someone does say a bad thing, we have a tendency to interpret that as, oh, well, they're a bad person, that's why they did that bad thing. But in fact, if you really look at a lot of cases, it tends to be the context or something about the situation that affected them and made them do a bad thing. They might not always be a bad person. So the fundamental attribution error describes our how we typically assign blame to the person because it's who they are, rather than the power of the situation. So if we apply that lesson to the context of social media, I think sometimes that can help us get around, thinking the worst about someone who is really, you know, acting in a way that looks pretty bad. For example, they're very outraged or saying really nasty things. Well, consider how the context of Facebook and the influence of algorithms, maybe that person is just kind of acting like they think other people act, and they're really like following a norm that they generally perceive, and it's not necessarily their fault. Again, sometimes people say things where even if that's true, maybe you still don't want to talk to them. But it's just something that I think could help us at least regulate our emotions sometimes when we see some things going on and when we're trying to make an assumption about what their intentions are.
You know, this morning we saw the news that Tucker Carlson is out at Fox News. Still waiting on some more details on that, but he's already done his last show there. That was last Friday. You know, do you see a connection between this online outrage and the sort of broader media landscape in which we're living in that does sort of traffic in anger all the time?
Yes, it's definitely the case that there are certain platforms. I mean, Fox News and Tucker Carlson are a great example, where they're really following a trajectory that has been around in the U.S. since the 1970s, at least when it comes to politics. So if you look at like evangelical TV networks that were trying to organize a political right by doing some outrage stoking, like people like, you know, Jerry Falwell, there's a lot of different examples. Social media definitely has inherited some of that. And I think the reason is just because people, whether implicitly or explicitly, they're learning that if you rile people up, you're going to get more engagement. And actually, in some of my other research that we didn't talk about today, I've demonstrated that people are actually learning over time what type of ways of talking are getting more engagement. So in other words, getting more likes and more shares. And whether implicitly or explicitly, like I mentioned, they're actually learning to produce more of that content over time. So I think, you know, sometimes it's very hard not to be hyper-responsive to getting more that boost of that we get when we other people are liking our content. I think the analogy you drew is great, and it does translate directly to social media.
Well, I guess I'm just gonna have to go back to that New Yorker cartoon I've kept around for, I don't know, more than a decade now, where it's a picture of a guy sitting on a couch on the phone and he just says, "I'm just sitting here waiting for Facebook to go away." William Brady is Assistant Professor of Management and Organizations at the Kellogg School of Management. The piece in the study, I should say, in Nature Human Behavior is Overperception of Moral Outrage in Online Social Networks Inflates Beliefs About Intergroup Hostility. William Brady, I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thanks for having me.
And that is all the time we have for our program today. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to be talking about that Supreme Court decision, or I should say lack of a decision, stay basically, that is going to allow abortion pill access to remain as it has, at least for the time being, while a challenge to that FDA approval is continuing through the courts. We're going to talk more about how some groups in Illinois have been responding to that and preparing for whatever outcome may come from that case eventually. Plus, we're going to be talking with the author of a book who is an environmentalist and says other people who are environmentalists ought to get on board with hunting. And that is going to be coming up tomorrow. The book is called The Shotgun Conservationist. That's all coming up tomorrow on the 21st Show, which is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our interns are Owen Henderson and Anaya Jones. Our piece on zero waste lifestyle was originally produced by Chantal Vaca. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.